Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo. Along with Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists, it is my pleasure to introduce you to Music at Menlo's 2010 season, Maps and Legends. In 2004, the festival's second season, we embarked on a musical odyssey with stops in five singular musical regions. This season, we expand on that journey to explore music from a spectrum of remarkable times and places, from the rich musical traditions of Vienna, England, and Spain, to Dvorak's America, 1920s Paris, and beyond. Maps and Legends will offer listeners many layers of context in which to engage with a broad spectrum of great music. This season's audio notes are designed to illuminate some of these layers. Over the course of this summer's concerts, encounters, and other festival events, we'll only continue to discover more of the innumerable connections that make the chamber music literature so rich. The third installment of this season's audio notes discusses two of this summer's concert programs. On this disc, we'll explore one of modern history's most spirited cultural periods alongside some of the 20th century's darkest years. Concert Program 5, La Ville Lumière, transports us to one of Western history's most dynamic settings, Paris in the Roaring Twenties. An astonishing cadre of influential artists and thinkers across all disciplines nourished the cultural landscape of 1920s Paris. Writers like Ernest Hemingway and Gertrude Stein, painters Pablo Picasso and Marcel Duchamp, the choreographer Sergei Diaghilev, the entertainer Josephine Baker, and many more. Likewise, Paris's concert scene represented a broad spectrum of musical styles, courtesy of composers ranging from Gabriel Fauré and Maurice Ravel to Sergei Prokofiev, Aaron Copland, and George Gershwin. Two decades later, Western Europe was engulfed in the Second World War. In 1945, Dresden, one of the continent's cultural centers and a symbol of the Germanic music tradition, was destroyed in an Allied bombing. Composers responded to the trauma of war with some of the century's most deeply felt music. One of the most poignant utterances of this period was Richard Strauss's Metamorphosen, a solemn elegy for the destruction of Germany and the fall of German culture. Metamorphosen begins this summer's fourth concert program titled Aftermath, 1945. The program will also offer music composed by Benjamin Britten and Dmitri Shostakovich in response to that traumatic chapter of Western history.
In 2003, Music at Menlo presented a song cycle by the American composer Ned Roram called Aftermath, which Roram composed following the September 11th attacks. Roram wrote the following in his program note. In the wake of the September 11th shock, I asked what 1,000 other composers must have asked. What is the point of music now? But it soon grew clear that music was the only point. Indeed, the future will judge us, as it always judges the past, by our art more than by our armies, by construction more than by destruction. The art, no matter its theme or language, by definition reflects the time. A waltz in a moment of tragedy, or a dirge during prosperity, may come into focus only a century later. Composers facing the aftermath of the Second World War must have wrestled with the same question pondered by Roram. In the wake of such crisis, they might have asked, what is the point of music now? Between the 13th and 15th of February, 1945, American and British forces dropped 2,600 tons of explosive and incendiary bombs on the German city of Dresden. The attack destroyed a city that had emerged as one of the Western world's major centers for the arts and sciences. A flourishing cultural center was reduced to rubble. A recent study by the Dresden Historians Commission concluded that the bombing resulted in up to 25,000 civilian casualties. The attack remains one of the most controversial events of the war. While nowhere near the equivalent of the war crimes perpetrated by the Nazi regime, the destruction of Dresden, a refugee haven with no military importance, represented a troubling departure from the values of the Allied forces. The senseless devastation wrought by the attack became a symbol of the profound calamity of war. 1,000 composers must have asked, "What is the point of music now?" But it soon grew clear that music was the only point. As artists have done throughout history, rather than retreat into silence, composers responded through their art. This summer's fourth concert program, Aftermath 1945, brings together works by Richard Strauss, Benjamin Britten, and Dmitri Shostakovich, three composers who responded to the war's aftermath with some of the century's most powerful music.
Following the deaths of Richard Wagner in 1883 and Johannes Brahms in 1897, Richard Strauss became recognized as Germany's most important living composer. He was one of classical music's most acclaimed international celebrities over the first half of the 20th century. Though he composed across all significant genres, Strauss primarily established his reputation with his colorful operas and tone poems. Such spirited and extroverted works as Der Rosenkavalier, Don Quixote, and Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks. But Strauss's music took a new direction near the end of his life. In contrast to the exuberance of his most widely known works, the music he composed in his final years was contemplative and austere. Strauss's most intensely personal work from this period was Metamorphosen, a sprawling, single-movement work ultimately scored for 23 solo strings. Our fourth concert program this summer begins with Metamorphosen in Strauss's original conception for string septet. Strauss began planning Metamorphosen in 1944 and completed it the following year in the wake of the Dresden bombing. The work is as much a lament for Germany's cultural destruction as for its physical ruin. Strauss was especially shaken by the destruction of the Munich Opera House, the site of many artistic triumphs during his career and a meaningful symbol of German culture.
In the 23-string version, it is probably one of the most difficult works to sustain.
Violinist Georgia Flizanis.
Because it is a piece that was written out of, I think, tremendous nostalgia and sadness for Strauss, you know, who was clearly watching and witnessing his entire environment and his whole world being bombed to smithereens in World War II. I think this is a response to the destruction of humanity, as it can just simply wipe out things that one imagines are there for eternity, and how completely helpless, in a way, anything that one imagines represents the symbol of culture. And this, I mean, we think of Carnegie Hall, and if you thought of a bomb just obliterating it suddenly, I mean, you would be torn as an artist who lived and saw your works premiered in these places, and that they represent, like temples, the personification of culture. And I think for him to have witnessed the destruction of Dresden and Munich, I think the only thing that he could do to probably express his sadness would be to have written a piece of music. And that's what this music is.
Thank you.
So it's drenched in both his own tears and how he would choose to express them musically. But of course, it also has in it, as often as we know, so many composers do this, a bow to one of the most important of Germany's composers, who's Beethoven. And there's the music almost inevitably, I feel, takes us to the very most important quote in the piece, which is of the Eroica.
In its most overt lamentation for the fall of German culture, Metamorphosen quotes the funeral march from Beethoven's Eroica symphony.
It's from the slow movement of the symphony. Dum da dum dia da 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 di dum. Dum da dum di dum ti dum. It's from this movement, this falling da-dum, dee-dum, da-dum, dee-dum. That rhythmic pattern, it's in the music and it develops and develops.
The work's title, Metamorphosen, alludes to Ovid's Metamorphoses, the ancient Roman poem that describes the creation of the world. The metamorphosis depicted in Strauss's music, however, is the devolution of civilization to a more primitive state. The work comprises a series of interrelated musical ideas that, as the title implies, are slowly transformed into new motives. Also, at the end of his life, Strauss read the complete works of Goethe. One poem in particular resonated with Strauss while he was composing Metamorphosen.
No one can know himself, detach from himself, yet he tries to become every day what is finally clear from the outside, what he is and what he was, what he can and what he may.
Preliminary sketches for a discarded choral setting of this poem ultimately became part of Metamorphosen. Considering Strauss as the proud creator of pieces like the semi-autobiographical tone poem A Hero's Life, music critic Alex Ross suggests that, quote, the composer was musing in some deep way on the course of his life, perhaps questioning the philosophy of individualism that had long guided him, end quote.
This had to have as mammoth a kind of gesture in it to, I think, to really capture for Strauss what he felt were the amazing contents inside Germany. I mean, what represented Germany and in musical terms.
One important footnote to Metamorphosen is Strauss's complicated relationship with the Nazi regime. Adolf Hitler had a great appreciation for classical music. When he first ascended to power, Strauss optimistically exclaimed, "Thank God, finally a Reich Chancellor who is interested in art." Strauss went on to serve as president of the Reich Music Chamber from 1933 to 1935, in which capacity he hoped to shape various social reforms to the benefit of composers, things like extending copyrights. While serving in this post, Strauss also attended party functions and fraternized closely with Nazi leadership, including Hitler himself on multiple occasions. But despite his questionable associations, Strauss's only sincere allegiance seems to have been to music and music alone. His accommodation of Nazi directives ended where it came to musical matters. He resisted any actions that targeted the erasure of music by Jewish composers, and actively promoted the music of Mendelssohn and Mahler, among others. Strauss moreover collaborated with a number of Jewish artists throughout his career, and received criticism from both sides, from his Jewish colleagues for accommodating the Nazis, and from Nazi sympathizers for his Jewish associations. He once wrote to the Jewish writer Stefan Zweig, quote, "Do you believe that I have ever let myself be guided in any act by the notion that I am Germanic? For me, there are only two kinds of people, those with talent and those with none." End quote. The Nazi minister of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, might have offered the most accurate assessment of Strauss's position. Goebbels wrote about Strauss in his diary, "He is unpolitical, like a child." If Strauss's accommodation of the Nazi party was motivated solely by the ultimately unfulfilled hope that it would benefit Germany's cultural life, his decision to quote Beethoven's Eroica Symphony may carry additional significance. Beethoven famously intended to dedicate the Eroica to Napoleon, whom he believed embodied the ideals of the French Revolution. When he learned that Napoleon had crowned himself emperor, Beethoven angrily scratched out the dedication from his manuscript. As Strauss watched his hopes for a new, enlightened era in German culture evaporate, he may have felt a parallel between Beethoven's disillusionment with Napoleon and his own with Hitler.
These were obviously not normal times, and they must have been particularly exasperating and possibly the greatest challenge to his Germanness to be such a success and such a hero and such an emblem of Germany at one of its most horrific demonstrations of a strike against humanity. And given that he had a Jewish daughter-in-law and some of his most important musical colleagues at that time were Jews, I mean, Stefan Zweig, who I think was somebody he was working on as a librettist, I mean, the compromise to his idea of identity at that point, to be both, again, asked to be the representative of German music by the Nazis, and to know that he was at the same time having to bring this conflict that came right to the heart of his own relationship to his both family and his colleagues. I mean, it had to have been, for so many as we know, a time of reckoning. And I think in that sense, for him to be brought to his knees, it's devastating. I mean, it's as devastating as what made him write the piece, to hear the piece. It's probably one of the saddest pieces I know.
The Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich produced some of the 20th century's most fiercely expressive music. His music is even more compelling when considered in the context of the difficult circumstances surrounding his life and work. Shostakovich's name has become virtually synonymous with the intensity of his musical reaction to Stalinism. His work serves as a kind of musical chronicle of the harsh social conditions that followed the 1917 October Revolution, and life under Stalin's regime. Shostakovich's response to his socio-political climate is manifested in his oeuvre of 15 symphonies, 15 string quartets, and myriad other works, which collectively represent one of the 20th century's most significant artistic achievements. In addition to his catalog of concert music, Shostakovich was a prolific composer of incidental music for theater and film. In 1960, he wrote the music for a film called 5 Days, 5 Nights, which was set in the aftermath of the 1945 bombing of Dresden. Shostakovich worked on the score in Dresden, where he was surrounded by reminders of the destruction that had befallen the city just 15 years earlier. While working on the film score, Shostakovich was moved to write a new string quartet, a kind of dual meditation on the events of 1945 and his own present circumstances. The score's dedication reads, "In memory of victims of fascism and war."
In addition to commemorating the victims of the Second World War, Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8 in C minor, Opus 110, is an explicitly autobiographical work. In a letter to his close friend, the writer Isaac Glickman, Shostakovich wrote, quote, "When I die, it's hardly likely someone will write a quartet dedicated to my memory, so I decided to write it myself. One could write on the frontispiece, dedicated to the author of this quartet. The main theme is the monogram D-E-S-C-H, that is, my initials. In German notation, the note E-flat is spelled E-S, and B-natural is spelled H. Shostakovich's monogram..." anchors the quartet's sober introduction and recurs throughout the rest of the piece. Another autobiographical aspect of the quartet is Shostakovich's use of material from previous of his own compositions. Following the introduction based on the composer's initials comes a theme taken from his first symphony. The quartet comprises five movements, played without pause. The nervous tension that builds steadily throughout the opening largo erupts in a violent outburst, announcing the start of the second movement. Later in the movement, Shostakovich quotes a theme from his Opus 67 piano trio. This theme, evocative of Jewish folk music, served as an unmistakable statement of solidarity with Jewish culture and tradition, a dangerous position to embrace in Soviet Russia. The harrowing setting of this theme in the Eighth Quartet is even more rhetorically charged. The third movement is a sardonic waltz based on the DSCH motif. The movement ends with a single note quietly sustained in the first violin, as if the music is anxiously holding its breath. Three forceful chords begin the fourth movement. three angry chords, easily heard as the KGB's dreaded knock at the door, recur throughout the movement. Shostakovich scholar Harlow Robinson points out another possible significance to the three-chord motif. If a Soviet citizen saw a KGB informant enter the room, he would signal a warning by knocking under the table three times. The fourth movement also quotes a Russian revolutionary anthem tormented by grievous bondage. The quartet ends by reprising the elegiac music of the first movement. Discussing his Seventh Symphony in his memoirs, Shostakovich wrote the following words, which may equally well inform the Eighth Quartet. I feel eternal pain for those who were killed by Hitler, but I feel no less pain for those killed on Stalin's orders. I suffer for everyone who was tortured, shot, or starved to death. The majority of my symphonies are tombstones. Too many of our people died and were buried in places unknown to anyone, not even their relatives. Where do you put the tombstones? Only music can do that for them. I'm willing to write a composition for each of the victims, but that's impossible, and that's why I dedicate my music to them all.
The final composer on our Aftermath program is Benjamin Britten. Britten was arguably the greatest English composer of the 20th century. His most enduring contribution to the repertoire is his extensive catalog of vocal music. His opera, Peter Grimes, which premiered in 1945, began a renaissance in English opera. Britten also composed numerous song cycles. His Opus 41 cycle, A Charm of Lullabies, appears on this summer's second concert program, The English Voice. On that program's audio notes disc, we discuss the qualities of Britten's unique musical language. His music recalls what he identified as a synthesis of clarity, brilliance, tenderness, and strangeness in the work of the Baroque composer Henry Purcell, superimposed on the modern landscape of the 20th century. Another dimension of Britten's music is its close reflection of his personal values. Among the most definitive of these were his deep pacifist convictions. This quality is manifested most overtly in Britten's magnum opus, The War Requiem of 1961, a towering work for vocal soloists, chorus, and orchestra. A more understated but no less powerful testimony of Britten's anti-war sentiment is the work that closes our Aftermath program, his song cycle, The Holy Sonnets of John Donne.
In July 1945, following the success of his opera Peter Grimes, Britten received an invitation from the violinist Yehudi Menuhin to accompany him on a concert tour of Germany. The war had just ended, and one of the first performances of the tour was for an audience of survivors at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. Britten was deeply moved by the setting. The experience inspired him to set to music 9 of the 19 Holy Sonnets by the English poet John Donne. Though written more than 300 years before, the poetry's themes of death, repentance, and reconciling faith in God with worldly realities immediately resonated with Britain's experience of the war's aftermath. Scholar Joseph Stevenson has called the Holy Sonnets of John Donne, quote, one of the largest and most profound of Benjamin Britten's many vocal publications and one of the most distinguished of the 20th century, end quote. The second song in the cycle is a setting of Sonnet 14, Batter My Heart, Three-Personed God. The poem begins,
Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new.
Britain completed the setting of this poem on August 6th, the same day that the United States dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. In a startling coincidence, the director of the American nuclear program, J. Robert Oppenheimer, felt a close affinity with this same poem and had named the atomic test site in New Mexico Trinity.
Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you has it but not breathe, shine, and seek to mend. That I may rise and stand, or throw me and bend your force, to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I like a new sunstone.
One of the cycle's most poignant moments is the sixth song, which sets Sonnet 17.
Since she whom I loved hath paid her last debt to nature and to hers, and my good is dead, and her soul early into heaven ravished, wholly on heavenly things my mind is set.
Since she whom I loved hath paid her last debt,
the cycle ends on a defiant note, with John Donne's sonnet, Death Be Not Proud. Britain's setting is stoic and uncompromising. The music comes to a triumphant climax for the final words of this magnificent cycle, and death shall be no more. Death, Thou Shalt Die.